Agency owners, you know a lot about running and growing an agency, but what is often not known is how deals actually work. And I'm bringing on Matt Bodner, who is an expert in mergers and acquisitions, and he's going to talk all about how you can either get your company ready for sale, or if you want to buy other agencies, he goes through a great acquisition strategy in this episode. So let's get started. Hey, Raj Jha here with Agency Exits, and I'm here with Matt Bodner, who is going to give us a really cool look at a different angle on agency acquisitions, and that's from the M&A side. So thanks for being here, Matt.
Raj, thanks so much for having me on the show. I'm really excited.
So Matt, maybe you can start out by giving some context about your role in the M&A world and maybe specifically the agencies, and then we'll widen the lens out and then talk about M&A in general.
Perfect. Yeah, I think that makes total sense. So quick background on me, Raj. I'm from Nashville, Tennessee, grew up in Nashville. I worked at Goldman Sachs up in New York for a number of years out of college. Came back to Nashville about 13 years ago, to get involved in the private equity and investing world down here. Bought my first company in 2011, which is an IT services business. And since then, I've built up a portfolio of operating businesses that range from software to IT services, manufacturing, staffing, medical equipment, an agency that I've had for a couple of years, and then I've recently done two new deals in the agency space as well. So starting to get more active in the agency world. But you know, I've done north of $100 million worth of transactions, and mostly as a buyer, typically have a pretty long-term hold horizon. And so I think about the world from the buyer's lens, and that may be helpful as folks think about exiting. But I also think M&A is an incredibly valuable growth playbook, not only broadly, but especially in the agency world, because it's such a fragmented industry. Whereas I have a close friend, for example, who's in the dental space, and he's very successful, sold his company for eight figures, built it up, and he wants to go help dental businesses scale. And the ecosystem is just evaporating because so many people are out there buying dental practices and big PE roll-ups and stuff. And there's some structural elements of the agency world that make that less likely, especially given the creative bent and the uniqueness of a lot of different agencies. But it's such a fragmented industry, which is a perfect playground for M&A. So I think it's a great space to be in. And it's a really powerful growth tool if you know how to use it.
Yeah. So let's talk about that for a second, though, because I think the vast majority of agency owners think of it as they're growing their agency and it's one foot in front of the other. They'll scale by organic growth versus scaling by M&A. And whether you're on the sell side as an agency owner or you're on the buy side trying to bring together a bunch of different agencies under an umbrella, what do you see in terms of the using M&A as a tool? Because it's a very different thing and requires from the founder a whole different attention than does building it organically. So what do you see in those who are successful doing an M&A strategy versus those who are keep your heads down and then grind it out the long way?
Yeah, there's a couple elements there, right? So one is I talk to a lot of agency owners, especially since I've been hunting for deal flow in the agency space more recently. And it's amazing how many agency owners plateau out at certain thresholds, right? You get a lot of folks that maybe plateau in kind of the $300,000 to $500,000 range, get a lot of people that plateau around $1 million, up into maybe $2 to $3 million, then maybe $5 million. And then every now and then you have a breakaway that's doing eight figures or more in revenue, right? So it's a segment that I feel like there's all these natural kind of breakpoints. And a lot of that is driven by just the endemic nature of the agency business. And I think if you're stuck in a plateau, M&A can be a really cool way to break out of it. Mm-hmm. And I look at the math on that as the most obvious example is you don't have to do a huge deal to get a 20 or 30% growth rate just from a single transaction, right? In the simplest, if you buy a business that's doing 30% of the revenue of your business, that's as soon as that deal closes, you've grown by 30% without having to do any organic. And then if you start to, and we can put some real numbers behind that too, if we want to run some math on it. But if you start to do that, let's say once a year, which is not, it's a solid cadence, but it's not breakneck by any means, right? There's PE rollups that are doing 50 deals in a 7-year window, right? And they're just glomming everything they can on. One deal a year is pretty achievable without going crazy. It gives you plenty of time to integrate all this kind of stuff. And if you have an agency that's doing $2 million of revenue, right? You buy a $400,000 or $500,000 agency, right? So that's basically 20 to 25% growth when you close that deal. And a $500,000 revenue agency it isn't a huge company. It's probably three people, right? Or right. Maybe four if they have some sort of contractor network or something. So that's not some crazy lift, right? So then you go from 2 to 2.5. Mm-hmm. You know, the next year you do one more, you go from 2.5 to 3. The next year you do one more, you go to 3.5, right? In 3 or 4 years, you're going to wake up and you'll be double or even 2.5 times, 3 times larger than you were just from those deals. And then what gets me excited is, you know, I'm a deal guy, not necessarily an agency expert, but what gets me excited is when you start to look at the synergies that can come out of that. And mm-hmm. not even on the operational side, though, that's great. If they're paying for 2 copies of the same email marketing software or 4 HubSpot subscriptions or whatever, cool, HR, accounting, that kind of stuff. But really the magic is also in looking at cross-selling and upselling between the different companies. So if you have that $2 million agency and they go out and buy a $500,000 business, even if they're in the same business line, then there could still be opportunities to cross-sell, upsell. But if they're in adjacent business lines, there's tons, right? So if you have an SEO agency mm-hmm. and you go buy somebody who's doing $500,000 a year of hosting, right? Not only can you sell hosting now to all of your agent and your SEO customers, but you can turn around and sell SEO to all your hosting customers. Right. And you obviously won't get 100% adoption, but let's say you pick up 100K of new hosting revenue and maybe 50K of new SEO revenue. And suddenly that 500K acquisition is now 650K of revenue. And then
right.
you do every year you do that, or you add in a new capability with whether you're scooping up something in paid media or you're in a particular niche and you want to diversify into, and by that, like you're doing only healthcare companies and you want to mm-hmm. expand. And so you buy an agency that focuses on law firms or is industry agnostic or whatever. That's where it gets really powerful. And you don't have to be a master of lead flow. You don't have to be a master of customer acquisition. You don't have to do any of those things. All you have to do is find one company, ink a deal with them, and you've grown 30%. And then you do that once a year, which again, if you really wanted to be ambitious, even once a quarter is aggressive, but not
crazy
unsustainable, right? Yeah. If you have the right team and you know what you're looking for. So that's to me, I see a lot of agency owners that are stuck in some of these growth plateaus. I'll throw one other tidbit in here and we can unpack this more too, but there's also a special sweet spot of buying these really small agencies, the sole proprietor, mm-hmm. $200,000-$400,000 revenue agencies. Those are some of my favorite acquisition targets. And there's 2 different ways you can do deals like that. One is what I call an acqui-hire deal. The other is what I call a business giveaway. And it depends on what that owner, that business wants to do. But either one of those scenarios, I'll give you 2 examples. In the last probably 6 weeks, I've talked to 2 different agency owners that just from my outreach and conversations mm-hmm. in the space. One was doing $250,000 of revenue and had wanted to leave her agency for years. And she said, "Hey, Matt, I'm not going to leave because I have these long-term customers and I want to find a home for them." But she had a degree in something else. She was tired. She was burned out. She didn't want to do it anymore, but she wasn't going to abandon her 10-year plus customer relationships. Mm-hmm. And so that's a perfect candidate to take over her business. You could use some creative deal structure to probably buy it without even really needing to deploy any capital or
anything. Very little.
And then you're off to the races. I talked to another agency owner, almost exactly the same. She's doing 300K revenue. She wants to go open a candle making studio and she's burned out. And I have a agency that I work with right now actually hired me to basically help them, advise them on deals. And I was like, "Hey, you got to talk to these folks, Deanna and I forget, Miranda, mm-hmm. I think was the other one's name. But you got to talk to them because these are perfect layups. It's like you could close for $500 and a percent of revenue and suddenly you right. added, if you do both of those, like $600,000 of revenue to a business and picked up a book.
Financed it from cash flows. Yeah,
exactly. So
yeah,
that was a long answer, but it's stuff that I find really fascinating. And I think especially in agencies versus dental or tons of other sectors, whatever, you have a lot of sole proprietors, which makes that a really rich sort of field to mine mm-hmm. Or harvest for a lot of these smaller acqui-hire giveaway type deals.
Yeah. Let me layer one thing on there that I observed. And so you talked about the synergies and that's 100% true. Getting the synergies, whether it's a different market segment, whether it's a different product line, there's another thing that I think is underappreciated, which is with agencies, it's a people business and your success and your plateaus are usually dependent on whether or not you have the right people. And
yes.
So if you hit a plateau, you can either try to find that magical hire who you probably can't afford because you're always either too little margins because you got too many people or too big.
Yep.
If you can acquire your next COO, you can acquire your own CEO that lets you move to chairman. You can acquire a general manager who runs a division. When you start to think of that, even if you're doing an acquisition of not a acqui-hire, but regardless of deal structure, if you think about, can I assemble the dream team through acquisition, you make your life so much easier. It's a different challenge, but you're getting a person that can be the solution to a lot of your problems.
One of my mantras that I always try to live by, and I constantly still have to remind myself, is whenever I'm stuck, I always come back to the principle of who, not how. It's totally agree, right? It's so often, if you don't have the right people, it's anytime I'm stuck, like 95% of the time, it's because I don't have the right person, not because there's some wizard strategy, crazy thing that I'm not thinking of. I just don't have the right person. And so you're absolutely right. It's a, you can even, it's any capacity or capability within the business, right? It can be sales. It can be if you want to add on a paid media team. It can be tons of different things. And the crazy thing is, you could go build a sales force and you could go hire them, train them, spend 6 months ramping them up, see how many of them actually work out. Or you could just go buy a sales team that comes with revenue, which is crazy. Or those, the other, you buy a COO that pays for themselves day one, basically, because of the acquisition.
So even if the acquisition doesn't add anything to your EBITDA, if you solve the people problem and that's your growth bottleneck, you've still increased top line. And then the rest in terms of your own focus as a founder is gravy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that could enable you to scale again. Yeah. Even if you don't add a dollar of EBITDA to your business, adding those capabilities in a way where you're not having to come out of pocket and hire them without any, the constant sort of seesaw of the agency world of get business, staff up, then margin compress, get more, but, and it's just,
you're giving me PTSD because I lived it. But yeah, it's just, and I was like, I can't afford a good person. I hired a general manager, but then she flamed out and it's like, oh crap, what did I do? I hired a fractional COO. She was amazing. I couldn't afford her full time. But like the acquisition thing, which I really should have done for my own, is really, it's not a magic bullet because integration is hard. You have to shift your focus as a founder from client service and leadership internally to an external focus. So it can be really hard. But if you look at, okay, how do I unlock that and find someone who can take care of the in-house? So maybe the first deal that you do is that operations person. And then you can turn your mind to external. That is a much faster way to grow. And for some people who are secret deal junkies, that can be super rewarding.
Yeah, I'm fully on that side of the spectrum. I the first company I bought, I ran it for about 6 years, and I realized that I did not being the operator, the CEO, whatever you want to call it, and I was okay at it, but I wasn't great. And what I really loved was the deal side of things. And so if you can unlock that skill set or find that opportunity, or have the right people in your ecosystem that know how to do that stuff, it can be really value added.
Yeah. So we talked a lot about the sell side. On the buy side, that you own an agency, you want to acquire a bunch of others. Now let's flip it on its head and let's talk about, okay, so you've got an agency and regardless of how you got there, whether it's organic growth or you're building it, now you're thinking, I want to sell this thing or get ready to sell. So maybe let's talk about a few things like, when is an agency really ready? What are the buyers looking for? Maybe go through some stories about agencies that weren't ready and why, and then we can talk about the ones that are and what distinguishes the two.
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think it varies. Readiness is very fluid, right? It's more a question of what kind of outcome do you want? Because the two examples I gave you a minute ago, both of those business owners are ready to exit and they could find an exit for their business, but it's not going to be some massive payday, right?
Right.
And so really thinking about like, how do you, at any point you can find the off ramp, but you might be leaving a lot of dollars on the table if you're not thinking about the right things, if that makes sense. And so the stuff that really drives, in my opinion, agency valuations, and I look at valuations very much an art and not a science, and in my opinion, at least. And so there's a lot of different variables there. Probably the biggest overall determinant is, in just if you're zooming just into agencies in particular, is size, right? Mm-hmm. For nothing else, size is usually one of the largest determinants of an agency's valuation. Now, within a band of size, you can have a pretty wide variability. But size, and by that, the $500,000 agency, even if they were super buttoned up, and I'll give you a handful of different things that I would consider buttoned up or big value drivers, right, here in a second. But even if they were super buttoned up, let's say they're making their 50% margins and they're making like $200,000 or $300,000 a year, they're still only going to sell for like 2 or 3 times multiple, probably. Mm-hmm. Unless they have some astronomical growth rate, whatever, maybe they can push that a little bit higher, or they're crazy tech enabled, or there's some other special thing that's driving that value. But generally, they're going to trade for 2-3 turns of earnings or EBITDA. Whereas there's a couple breakpoints in earnings that I think drive much higher valuations. If we go to the other end of the spectrum, if you're doing high single digits of earnings, or I will typically say EBITDA, which I mean, I'm sure most of the, like, earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization, I'm sure you know what that is. But I just think EBITDA, I use them somewhat synonymously. In the agency world, they're actually pretty close to synonyms. If you're talking about a manufacturing business or something, there's all kinds of other crazy stuff that we won't go on a
some are like SDE, profit, yeah, EBITDA, like call, right? Different I'll, words. Think about the amount of money that's actually going to come out of the business.
I'll use EBITDA as the placeholder, because it means all those things in this example. So if you have, let's say, 8 to 10 million or high single digits, low double digits of EBITDA, you're easily pushing 10 times or more, right? It depends mm-hmm. to some extent on what's going on, but the range of possible multiples for the very low end might be 2 to 3 times or even 1 times or less, depending on how dysfunctional that business might be, all the way up to, on the high end, it could be easily pushing into double digit multiples for, let's say, 10 million of EBITDA. And mm-hmm. then the middle ground has, that's where those ranges start to merge. And so you have, if you're doing, let's say, $500,000 of EBITDA, which, back of a napkin, you have a $2.5 million revenue agency at a 20% margin, that's $500K of profit, right? So mm-hmm. that business, probably midpoint of its range, would probably be somewhere in the 3.5 to 4x range, with, if it was really dysfunctional, low growth rate, super reliant on the founder, could push into the 2.5 to 3 range. If it was super robust management team, high growth rate, tech enabled, high margins, all that kind of stuff, could push into the 5x range, or maybe even a little higher than that. And so if you scale that up a notch, let's say you have maybe $1 million or $2 million of EBITDA, that's where, in most businesses like that, even if it's to some extent reliant on the founder, there's enough meat on the bone there that you could bring in a really high powered executive, right? So if you mm-hmm. have a $2 million EBITDA business, if you have to hire somebody and pay them $250,000 a year of compensation, I'll just make that number up, that's 10% of your EBITDA, or maybe 12% or whatever. You still have $1.75 million left over after you do that of earnings to pay for debt service or growth or finance the deal or whatever. Whereas if you have a business that's doing $1 million of revenue and $200K of profit, you can't hire that person without buying the company and immediately going negative.
And I don't want to interrupt you, but there's one other layer, because people hear these numbers and they can sound really big, potentially. There's another layer which people don't often think about, that, which is, what's your earnout? The smaller you are, the worse your earnout. So it's not like you're getting a check exactly on day one. If you're at the lower end of the range, you probably ain't getting a check at all on day one. If you're at the high end of the range, you might walk away with a check. So
yes,
one other layer, just before people get too excited. Sorry to interrupt.
No, you're totally right. You're totally right. Yeah. And we'll come back to that, because I think that's a super important thing, which is the vast majority of deals, unless we're talking about really big transactions, have at least some element of what I would broadly call deferred consideration, i.e. seller note, earnout, those kinds of things. And the smaller the deal, like those two little agency examples I gave you a minute ago, both of those would trade almost for a pure earnout. I would be surprised if those businesses transacted for any cash at closing, or some de minimis amount, right? Like $1,000 or something equivalent to that. Whereas a $10 million EBITDA business, as you said, they may have an earnout or some deferred consideration, but that will be largely cash, would be my presumption, or largely they're walking with most of those proceeds at closing. But midpoint would probably be, for if you're doing somewhere in a 500 to a million and a half of EBITDA, very rough rule of thumb, I'd say you're probably looking at 20 to 30% of deferred consideration, maybe a little more than that. And the other thing we touched on a little bit that we can start to unpack now is, like, what are those drivers? So if you say, okay, hey, a 500K agency, 500K EBITDA agency is going to trade for somewhere in the, let's just say, 3 to 5X range broadly. And it can push the boundaries on either side of that, but that's a pretty good rough proxy, just back of a napkin. What makes it worth a 3X and what makes it worth a 5X, right? So there's lots of different factors that go into that. But I'll laundry list a few of them. One of the most important is the reliance on the founder, the owner. So if it's just a job that comes along with a bunch of customers and some other stuff that somebody's going to have to step into and or meaningfully replace the owner, that's definitely going to push it to the lower side of the spectrum pretty meaningfully all the way. And that's also going to most likely raise the amount of deferred compensation or deferred consideration, i.e. seller notes that they're going to have. If so, that's one is founder involvement or reliance on the founder, reliance on the owner of the business. The next one I would say, these aren't necessarily in forced rank priority order, but just generally very important considerations. Growth rates are really important, right? So is the agency stagnant? Is it growing at 20% a year? Is it growing at 35, 40% a year? Is it growing? Is it shrinking at 10% a year? If fast grower is going to push it into a high multiple, slow, no growth or negative growth is going to push it down to the lower end of the multiple spectrum. Technology enabled is also, and now we'll obviously include AI in there, which is a huge component. Technology slash AI enablement and generally operating efficiency, which is not exactly the same thing, but you can also lump in just higher gross margin, higher profit, higher net margin agencies will typically price more attractively on the higher end of the spectrum. The more tech enabled you are, the better story you can tell around why you should trade for a higher price. You can also look at other things like volatility of historical revenues. So if the business is doing $5 million today, but it was doing $4 million the year before, but $8 million the year before that, but $2 million the year before, it's buyers don't like to see that crazy up and down roller coaster from their earnings. They want to see something that's really stable, consistent, and up and to the right. Now, that may not always be reality, but the more volatile the business is, the more it's going to push the multiple lower, typically speaking.
Yep.
So those are a couple different variables that I would say are some of the most important. Also, operating history. So as this agency was founded 18 months ago, even if it's doing $5 million of revenue, the question is, okay, is this a flash in the pan? Are they capitalizing on some trend that's immediately going to go away? Like I was talking to an agency owner a couple of weeks ago who had an agency that was doing run rate of over $10 million of revenue, maybe 18, 24 months ago. And he was 100% serving the crypto market. All customers said, but huge pipeline, riding high. He had an offer on the table for, I forget the number, but it was like $15 million or some big number that he was contemplating and decided not to take. And then obviously the crypto crash happened and now he's doing like $1 million of top line.
Yeah.
And now his mind is still anchored to the like, but I could have gotten this big number, but the business isn't, it's not going to trade there anymore.
Yeah. Right?
It's going to trade way lower than that. And having that's a volatility, but it's also if it's short term, right? If you started this thing up and it's even then when he was trying to sell it, it's this agency's been around for 18 months. Even if you rocketed up to 10 million, what happens if the trend goes away and it goes back down really rapidly, right? So those are a few factors that I would say are some of the most important. Other ones to think about would be I'll give you a quick laundry list. We don't have to go deep into, but like how the sale process is run, how competitive it is or not, whether the books are clean and the financials are really easy to decipher, or whether they're really messy. SOPs, documentation, employee retention strategies and plans. So do they have management depth, which is not exactly the same thing as being reliant on the founder, but is close. Is there a bus problem? Is there one person there who's a single point of failure? All of these things. And then the sellers, for better or worse, like the seller's personal circumstances are also a meaningful driver, right? So if the seller is highly motivated and they have some life catalyst that's forcing them to need to sell, that's probably going to drive the valuation down versus saying, hey, I'll entertain offers, but I'm sitting happy and I don't need to sell anytime soon unless I can cherry pick something that's just the perfect deal or the perfect offer for me.
Yeah, that is a great list. I think when I boil it down for a lot of folks who are interested in selling, I usually say this, that valuation is, and what you're going to get for the business is really, it's a risk decision, right? How much risk are you putting on the buyer? Because they're deploying capital in order to get a return on capital. And the more risk you pile on the buyer, the less they're going to pay for that. So if you just think about that as the shorthand and put your I'm a buyer hat on and say, oh, it's risky because if I get hit by the bus, if I founder get hit by the bus, the whole thing is dead. Clearly, that's not worth a lot. If on the other hand, I'm hit by the bus and the thing keeps chugging along, that's great. If it keeps growing, that's even better. What are the chances that somebody finds a landmine in the financials? If you've got a really good data room and you put that together, less likely you're going to get less of a challenge on your price. So just always have that. Would I buy this business? If I were buying this business, my own business, what would I think is like the biggest red flag? And that's your laundry list of things to be fixing.
Yep. Yeah, that's a great perspective. I was chuckling when you're talking about financials, because I a couple of weeks ago, I was looking at an agency's financials and it was just an Excel sheet basically that they had hacked together. So kind of more of a solopreneur, small agency, but it's not that uncommon to see setups like that, especially in these smaller businesses. Or the agency business is one where a lot of times the founder is super creative. And oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes that creative mindset is like the opposite of the mindset that's doing the accounting, right? For better or worse. And so a lot of agency founders and owners, especially less sophisticated ones, and in my experience, their books aren't super clean and their records are messy and all that kind of stuff. And that's most small businesses as a whole, right?
Yeah, that's general for the category. But I think agencies in general, it's interesting because you can start an agency with essentially $0. And you just go out there and you find it and you can find some freelancers to help you and you can just glue it together. You have to get to that level of sophistication where you can look at it and say, and even if you're a creative, I would say this is mandatory. It's, do I understand my company's margin? Do I understand margin per client? Do I understand margin per service line? Even if you don't really, even if you're recoiling from like margins, it's a number, and have your bookkeeper provide that number. And then you start to understand about the business and how a buyer would look at the business. And frankly, you're just going to get better at it, understanding it's, hey, like I did. 3 years in, and I'm looking at it, and it's like, why are my margins not there? And I look at it, it's like, my biggest client is losing me money.
Yeah. And not knowing that, not understanding that, which is also, depending on the smaller you go, the more frequently you'll see those kinds of things.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
The other thing, you hit on this a minute ago, but the structure, which is the term that I would use for how much you're getting paid up front versus how much you're getting paid over time. Deal structure, terms, whatever you want to call it. Structure is also typically very risk driven, right? So the riskier the business, the lower the valuation and the more structure.
Right.
So those things are, it's almost like negatively compounding. You're going to get paid less and it's going to be more structured. And the less risky the business, the more they're willing to pay you up front and the more they're willing to pay you in general. So they exponentially multiply positively or negatively, depending on which path you're taking. And we touched on some of the math of this a few minutes ago too, but it just endemically, if you think about a $10 million revenue or sorry, $10 million EBITDA business, like that business is probably doing $30, $40, $50 million of revenue. It probably has, gosh, I don't even know, like 50 employees, 100 employees, depends on how you structure it, but a ton of employees. They probably have, customer concentration is another huge one.
Oh, that's right.
Penalize you on valuation, but they probably have a pretty diversified customer base. Versus a tiny agency, if you're doing $300,000 or $400,000 of revenue, you might have like three clients, or you might have one big client.
Right.
I was talking to another agency owner a couple weeks ago who they basically had 90%+ concentration to a single client, and they were serving effectively as like their outsourced marketing agency.
Yeah.
Now it was a marketing agency almost like a division. This is like a Fortune 500 company that you and I both know the name of. They were doing a bunch of marketing work for, but that company decided it was a software business. And they decided when software got hurt 18, 24 months ago to slash their marketing budget, right? They're a third party marketing firm. And so they similarly saw a huge plummet in their revenues and they were rethinking their business model and reworking everything and trying to figure out how to make it work and all this stuff. But that's also a big risk decision, right? That's why you don't want to have a highly concentrated business. And why, if you do, someone's not only going to want to pay you less, but they're going to pay it over time to see, hey, if your customer sticks around for 5 years, I'll pay you all this money. But if they leave me 18 months in, I don't want to be the person holding the bag.
Exactly. Exactly. So when you're looking at an agency, let's say a slightly larger one, because there's with the more solopreneur-ish sub $500,000 ones, that it runs the gamut. But let's say you're looking at $1 million in revenue and up. What would you expect to see if someone came to you and said, I'm thinking of selling this thing. Are you interested? What kind of structure would you want to see? Because I know I have my answer to this and there's a certain list of things when any of my businesses get to $1 million, I have them like professionalized in certain ways, but that's supposedly to make it easy for me. It's okay, we're at $1 million. We're making the data room now so I don't have to make it when we're at 10.
Yep.
What are some of the things that you would want to see and expect to see? And if you didn't, you'd be like, I'm not sure this is real.
In terms of how they put together their diligence materials or just company structure?
It could be company structuring. It could be at least plans, contingency plans for key man being out. What are some of those things which would just flag a deal as I'm not so sure about this, like the big red flags?
I think it's the inverse of all the things we talked about a minute ago, right? Probably number one red flag for me is if I'm not looking at it as a bolt-on deal or an add-on, which is that idea of you have an existing agency, you're adding a smaller one onto it. Mm-hmm. So if I'm not looking at it as a bolt-on, probably the single biggest disqualifier is management and owner involvement. So if it's massively reliant on the owner, it's almost an insta-pass, right? Mm-hmm. If I'm looking at it as a standalone acquisition, because it creates a whole bunch of headaches and challenges and other things I don't want to deal with. So that's an easy one. Massive customer concentration. Also, not a hard pass, but I wouldn't do a massively customer concentrated deal without a meaningful amount of deferred compensation, right? Mm-hmm. So way more than market, like way more than market. As somebody once told me, a good rule of thumb, and it's, you don't always see sellers happily signing up for this, but like a good rule of thumb is your percent of your earnout or seller financing, seller note, et cetera, is the percent concentration to your largest customer.
Oh, that's really interesting.
So that's
I never thought about that, but that's a really interesting.
People don't always agree with that or like that, but it's a good just litmus test, right?
Yeah.
So it's okay. Would you be cool if you're 50% concentrated? Would you be cool with 50% of your deal proceeds sitting out there for 5 years to ensure that customer doesn't vanish into the night?
I'm gonna steal that thinking tool.
There we go. But yeah, for me, it's really like, I think those are probably two of the biggest disqualifiers.
Mm-hmm.
And then is the company super? Is it a mess or is it something that there's good bones, for lack of a better term? Mm-hmm. And I'm definitely a subscriber of the philosophy. I don't want to buy distressed businesses. I want to buy from distressed sellers, mm-hmm. right? I want to buy a good business from a distressed seller, not a distressed business from a good seller. So to me, I want to see if a business is really struggling and they can't make payroll, they're in a tough situation. I want to understand the drivers of that, but that alone is also going to probably scare me or say, hey, I'm really going to rethink this thing. Why do I want to step into a mess or a landmine? Unless it's like, hey, I'm throwing my hands up and I'll give you this thing for percent of revenue.
Please take this.
And we have management to run it. So if it was an add-on, sure. Assuming we liked the customers and the culture and whatever. But if it was a standalone, even then it would probably be not super interesting, or it'd probably be a pass. Yeah.
Let me ask you another question. Since you're active in the buying space on agencies, you're looking at them actively. How are you thinking about how fast and hard AI is coming into the space in terms of what is an agency worth? Because there are client relationships, but cost of delivery now in some areas of agency delivery has gone markedly down. Now, we're in this period where the market doesn't fully realize this. Not all agencies realize this, but you fast forward 5 years and it's like common denominator that pretty much is table stakes to be using AI for a lot of things. How are you thinking about that trend and how should agency owners be thinking about where they might want to say, I might want to sell sooner while the world is still as we understand it, or do I want to double down and adopt these AI things and try to be cutting edge and extract enterprise value in another way? How are you viewing that problem?
I think this perspective will change with time, because I think the end point, as you pointed out too, the end game is this is table stakes in, I don't know when, 3 years, 5 years. At some point, if you're not doing it, you're probably going to go out of business because your margins are going to get crushed, right? Mm-hmm. Or people are going to be out competing you, stealing your customers, whatever. And so to me, it's a necessary component ultimately of a successful agency is to be really harnessing AI and offshoring and all of these different elements. Right now, there's a few nuances that maybe don't perfectly fit that. If you're super PR focused or super branding focused or something, maybe there's some elements that you can make a case against doing some of that stuff. But to me, I look at it as ultimately it's table stakes. In the near term, I think it's you have to look at your specific agency and say, hey, is this something, am I good at this? And am I on the, maybe not the cutting edge, but am I on the fast part of the adoption curve? Mm-hmm. Or is this something that I don't want to deal with? And if depending on where you fall on that spectrum, I would say that would inform the decision to some extent to say, hey, if I feel like I know what's going on with ChatGPT and DALL-E 3 and some of these image generation technologies and all the video automation and AI creation that's happening and all this other stuff. I'm using these tools. My team's using them. We're seeing the value, but we're not super all in on it. I think I would lean heavier into that. If you're saying, I don't understand this stuff at all, and we're doing traditional media buys for car dealerships, then I would think about, okay, hey, you're probably okay for a little while, right? But eventually there's going to be a big disruption point. So if I was in that scenario, I'd say I'd probably lean towards selling, or I'd really think about investing in that capability, or maybe acquiring for that capability of AI expertise.
Or the other thing, and I've had a number of discussions with agency owners about this, is recasting as where's the value? Because if you look at as an enterprise, what is the enterprise value? And it used to be that it was essentially, you've got a collection of clients and it's throwing off a certain margin, that EBITDA is the value. But as the margin that you can get gets compressed with technology, the value proposition of the entity goes more towards the intangible, right? It goes towards the strategy. It goes towards the brand, because those are things where you can make an app that gives me a brand in a box and I'm going to hit it and the AI is going to come out with it. But literally, that's not how enterprises buy. So you've got a much longer runway there. So if you're upping your client base and you're going more towards the branding and the intangibles, I think you have a longer runway versus the strict lead gen pump in Facebook ads and Google ads, which is essentially step one was offshoring, next step AI, next step no margin.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And yes, that's definitely my perspective, or I think we have a very similar view around that. And if you look at, there's certain subsectors of the agency world, right? So paid media, lead gen, et cetera, that are maybe more vulnerable to that, or will it be impacted by that on a sooner trajectory than branding agency, right? But even then, you can use some really cool AI tools for branding. But I definitely agree that I think if I was looking at my business today, I think you have to make a judgment call to say, am I going to double down on AI and it's something that I'm pretty savvy at? Or is it something where I don't have a capability and I need to offload this or find somebody who does? I think the other thing, so in a post AI world, or what are the value drivers without AI? You hit on a couple of them. I think it's also culture to some extent.
Right? Good point.
Do you have a really strong culture? Do you have good people? Mm-hmm. Right. As we talked about, who, not how, people is really the key, one of the fundamental elements of scaling an agency. And so if you have really good people, you have a good culture, you have solid customer relationships, those are all really positive value drivers. Even if you're not AI enabled, that would make you much more valuable than a business that might have some AI, but maybe they don't have some of those things.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. One last topic I want to delve into before we wrap up, and that's trends. Since you're active in the market and you purchased one agency a while ago, you've been in M&A for a long time, purchased an agency a while back, actively talking to and looking to others now. What are some trends that you're seeing? One thing that I've noticed, and I don't have numbers around this, and I'd love to get numbers around this, is that valuation might have more to do with market timing than anything else. I just see these cyclic waves where if you were trying to unload your agency last year, it was just a terrible time. But 5 years ago, 4 years ago, you're high-fiving if you unloaded it. I'm seeing certainly that as just as this market cyclic thing that happens. But what else are you seeing about trends specifically now, and that you might forecast in the next couple of years, that people should be start having the back of their minds, like, I might want to think about the timing of a transaction?
Yeah. So AI is probably one of the biggest, right? I'm starting to see a bifurcation. And if we think about economics and basics of capitalism, at some point, pricing should come down as a result of this. But I'm starting to see a bifurcation of agencies that I talk to where they're the old school, more old school model. Folks, I typically see a reasonably well-run agency will operate somewhere in a 20% margin, at least in my experience. And a really well-run AI-driven agency will be pushing like 50% margins right now. So the question is, does that eventually compress to 20% and price competition, et cetera, drives that down? It's obviously not happening immediately. And so that's one of the big things I see, is I can almost just see somebody's margin and tell whether or not they're AI-driven or whether they're meaningfully leveraging some of that stuff. The other thing where maybe coming out of the fog on this to some extent, but I've definitely seen some belt tightening, budget cutting, et cetera, over the last 18 months of customers in terms of customers shrinking down marketing spend, pulling back spend a little bit. It depends on what sector they're operating in and also what service model they're doing. So whether the business is focused around SEO, paid media, whatever. But that's been, I've seen a lot of folks say less now, but definitely a lot 6 months ago say, hey, some of our customers are pulling back a little bit, shrinking ad budget a little bit, shrinking marketing budget a little bit. Trying to think what other big trends I see in the space right now. Really, I think it continues to be an extremely fragmented space. I think structurally will always be more fragmented than some industries that have seen just monstrous PE consolidation.
Yeah.
But I do think there will continue to be a decent amount of consolidation in the space, right? So it will never hit some of the more hyper mature, hyper consolidated industry thresholds. But I do think there's going to continue to be consolidation in the space as people get more sophisticated, people get better about tech stacks and fulfillment, and they're looking for ways to add on customers very quickly or scale very quickly.
Right.
There's similar to e-commerce in a lot of ways, but there's just a lot of aggregators out there. There's a lot of people glomming agencies together. And I think right now it's like the Wild West. There's just so many agencies out there that it's a really, I think there's a lot of greenfield left to go and scoop firms up or do this. But at some point, it'll get more picked over. It'll get a little more consolidated. And so to me, that's another larger trend that I am seeing in the space, at least just from the conversations I've been having with folks.
Interesting. Has any of the increase in cost of capital flowed into this? I know the venture funds are now, interest rates are high. How can we deploy money and actually make enough for our LPs? I know agency owners don't often think about this, but essentially the amount that one, the returns one's going to get on investment has to be competitive. And if interest rates are super high, it makes investing in more speculative businesses more difficult. Are you seeing that effect, or are agencies stable enough that's not really an effect in the M&A world?
From a valuation standpoint, on the lower end of the spectrum, I don't see as much of an impact, right? Because the lower purchase price you're paying, the less rate sensitive it is, generally speaking. So if you're paying 12 times EBITDA, you're going to be more rate sensitive than a business where you're paying two or three times EBITDA, just because there's the purchase price is a lower, it's just a lower number. It's a lower percentage of the enterprise value, like all these kinds of things that basically make it so leverage isn't going to hit you as hard, or a rate environment's not going to impact your valuation as much because there's not much room to shrink, right? Whereas if you're at 10 times and cost of capital goes up and people are, hey, I'm only going to pay eight times for that asset, at $10 million EBITDA, that's a shrinkage of two turns. That's a $20 million loss in enterprise value, right?
Huge.
Whereas if you're at three, because the market's a little frothy and you're doing a couple hundred grand and maybe you go to 275 or something, I'm talking about like 50 grand or something.
Yeah.
So much less of an impact anecdotally. The biggest flow through that I've seen around that is what I was talking about a second ago, which is basically software companies, their venture backing pulls back. Agencies that are serving software companies, which there's a lot of those out there, they see a slash in budget, right? So it's more customer constriction. Most agencies, not all of them, but most agencies, as you hit on, there's not a huge startup cost. So most agencies aren't highly levered, at least in my experience. I've seen a few that have some SBA loans and some other stuff sitting on their books. But the vast majority of agencies that I see hunting around in the market are debt-free businesses or largely debt-free businesses. And so they're not getting squeezed by the rate environment on their operating expenses or their debt service or
whatever. It's mostly on the acquisition side. If someone's looking to lever the buy, then would that cause a difference? Yeah.
But the smaller the deals, the multiple's so low that it doesn't matter.
It's not having as big of a flow-through impact. That's a really good way of thinking about it. So Matt, we've covered a lot of ground today and you've given a lot of insight from having a broader M&A perspective. So I really appreciate that. Any last words that you have to the agency owners before we talk about where people can find you and learn more about this stuff? Any last like words of wisdom you can give for someone who's either looking to sell or looking to buy other agencies?
I would say if you're looking to sell, you should definitely think about reducing customer concentration, finding a way to scale yourself out of the enterprise or replace yourself. Those are going to be some major drivers that are somewhat controllable that are going to have a big impact on valuation. If you're thinking about growing, then if you haven't considered it, and for some reason, I think because marketing agencies, their job is marketing, they mostly only consider organic growth when they're thinking about growth strategies. And so mm-hmm. if you want to grow, consider M&A as a strategy that you hadn't previously thought about. I think it's a really powerful growth strategy. The best PE firms and some of the most successful investors in the world, it underpins pretty much their whole investing strategy. And it works really well. It scales really nicely into even these tiny little $200,000-$300,000 deals that you can find all over the place in the agency world. Mm-hmm. And so to me, I would think about at least exploring that as a thought exercise as a possible growth strategy. I think it's a really underappreciated and powerful means of growing a business.
Fantastic. That is awesome. Matt, I know you've got an amazing newsletter that talks all about this stuff. Can you share where people should hunt you down and how what other kinds of information you can get them?
Absolutely. Yeah. My website's just mattbodner.com or any of my socials, you can find me. I have a free newsletter called the Deal Mastery Insider, where we talk about how to find deals, how to structure them, how to fund them, how to get the capital, all these different elements. Talk about case studies and playbooks of doing these kinds of acquihire deals and other things that we've talked about today. But yeah, check me out if you want to learn more about how to do deals.
Fantastic. Matt, thanks so much for coming on and sharing your wisdom.
Awesome. Raj, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. And it was great to chat.